From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Stay Tuned. I'm Preet Bharara.
You have election deniers, you know, Stop the Stealers, running for Secretary of State in Georgia, in Arizona, and elsewhere. And you're putting them in a position, if they're elected, to actually have the pin on certifying results. What's going to happen in 24?
That's Chris Krebs. He's the former director of CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at DHS. CISA was established in 2018, and as director, Krebs dedicated much of his time to strengthening the physical and cybersecurity of America's voting systems. He also spoke out against election-related misinformation, which ultimately cost him his job. In the days after Joe Biden was declared the winner of the 2020 election, Krebs testified before the Senate.
The 2020 election was the most secure in U.S. history.
He was fired by former President Trump, who was then in the early stages of perpetuating the big lie. Now he's a founding partner at the Krebs Stamos Group, a firm that helps companies and organizations navigate threats to cybersecurity. Krebs joins me to discuss the great Facebook shutdown of October 2021, election security, and why voting by phone might not be such a great idea. That's coming up. Stay tuned.
Can we think of the Earth itself as a living entity?
Cells are alive. A leaf is alive. A tree is alive. So is a forest a living thing? Is the whole planet alive?
I think we can think of Earth as a genuine living entity in a meaningful sense and in a scientific sense.
This week on Unexplainable, the Gaia Hypothesis. Follow Unexplainable for new episodes every Wednesday.
It's time for some listener questions. This question comes in an email from Becky, who asks, are there any tea leaves to be read from the news that Joel Greenberg, Representative Matt Gaetz's former associate, has asked a federal judge to delay his sentencing? What kinds of information could he be providing to prosecutors? Becky, that's a good question. People will remember that Joel Greenberg is someone who pled guilty to a series of crimes. He faces a mandatory minimum sentence of 12 years in federal prison, but he appears to be cooperating. In fact, we know he's cooperating because it has come out in court proceedings. The significance of cooperating and providing substantial assistance with respect to investigations of other people, including Representative Matt Gaetz, is pretty much the only way that Greenberg can get out from under the mandatory minimum sentence of 12 years. Now, what's interesting is the timeline here. At one point, Greenberg was scheduled to go to trial. On the eve of trial, he pled guilty. And then after you plead guilty to a crime in federal court, you get a sentencing date scheduled. Once upon a time, that sentencing date was August 19th of 2021. In advance of that sentencing, Joel Greenberg, in consultation with prosecutors and in agreement with prosecutors, asked for an adjournment of that so he could continue to provide substantial assistance through cooperation. And we've seen that happen a second time now. So instead of a sentencing taking place on November 18th of 2021, they've asked for that to be adjourned now to March of 2022. Now, that's not at all unusual in situations of cooperation. And what it means is prosecutors seem to be happy and satisfied with the information that Greenberg is giving them, probably with respect to Matt Gaetz. Does that mean there will definitively be a prosecution of someone else, Gaetz or anyone else, based on the cooperation of Greenberg? Not necessarily, but I will tell you, based on the multiple adjournments and the amount of time that has passed and prosecutors' seeming happiness with what's going on, the likelihood is quite high. People may be asking, what takes so long? Witness comes in, tells what he knows about someone else, and that's that. It's not always so simple as that. Sometimes the information is complicated. The most important thing you need with a cooperating witness, especially someone like Joel Greenberg, who is himself someone who has credibility problems and has pled guilty to his own crimes, is corroboration. And corroboration sometimes takes time. So for example, the cooperating witness like Greenberg might say something about a financial transaction or about a meeting or a communication, and it might take prosecutors some time to subpoena and find those communications to corroborate what Greenberg is saying. So I suspect some combination of the volume of information being provided and the need to meticulously corroborate that information is what's leading to the delay. Bottom line is, bad news for Matt Gaetz. This question comes in an email from Serge, who asks, were you surprised by DOJ's announcement that it is reviewing its decision not to prosecute the FBI agents who botched the Larry Nassar investigation. Have you seen something like this happen before? Of course, Serge is referring to the disgraced former USA gymnastics doctor who sexually molested and abused hundreds of his patients, some of whom were world-famous gymnasts. As you may recall from Stay Tuned and from other sources, on two separate occasions, both when Donald Trump was president and then again when Joe Biden became president, the Department of Justice made a decision to decline prosecution with respect to two FBI agents who were excoriated in an inspector general report, but basically said the FBI botched the investigation of Larry Nassar. Complaints were made to particular FBI field offices. Information wasn't shared. And then more ominously, it was alleged in the IG report that the FBI agents made false statements in connection with their investigation, and that can lead to criminal prosecution. So lots of people, including Senator Blumenthal of the Judiciary Committee, have been quite critical of the department, wondering why it is that there hasn't been a prosecution, why it is that there was that declination. Now, as you also may know from hearing me talk about legal cases over the last number of years and from reading my book, Doing Justice, it is a difficult thing to explain why you declined to prosecute a case. There are also circumstances in which, given the lack of public faith and the concern that Americans may have that maybe there was a declination because of a too close relationship with respect to a component of DOJ itself, maybe the declination of prosecution wasn't in good faith. Now, I doubt that's the case, but that's a concern people have. Lisa Monaco, my friend and our former colleague, both in the Justice Department and at CAFE, the Deputy Attorney General, came before the Senate Judiciary Committee and revealed that there hasn't been, apparently, a final decision not to prosecute those agents, and that new information has come to light and the investigation is ongoing and continues. That does not mean that DOJ will make a decision to prosecute them, but it means that it's still a possibility. What I find kind of interesting about that is, generally speaking, DOJ does not make pronouncements about investigations that are open and that are not completed. But I take it here, given the totality of the circumstances, the concerns that senators and ordinary people have had about why DOJ declined prosecution, that she made in her discretion the decision to have more transparency with the committee and with the American public. And I think in these particular circumstances, that's a good thing. And we'll see what happens. This question comes from Twitter user at Adam Travis G, who asks, do you care that Facebook was down? Answer, no. Well, look, that's speaking for me personally. As you'll hear in my interview with Chris Krebs, it does pose a question, and it causes people to wonder whether a very significant corporation, whether you like Facebook or not, millions and millions and millions of people rely on it. They rely on applications that are owned by Facebook, including WhatsApp and Instagram. WhatsApp, in fact, as Chris and I discuss, is the necessary tool of communication for many people in many countries in the world. And you wonder how vulnerable a monolith like Facebook is. That causes a concern. Is it too big? But we'll get to that in the interview in a few minutes. Stay tuned. There's more coming up after this. Support for Stay Tuned comes from Mint Mobile. The secret to Mint Mobile's premium but affordable wireless plans is that they sell them totally online. Mint Mobile was one of the first to cut out the costs of retail, and they then passed those savings on to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly plan or unexpected fees. You can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. That includes unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy and painless, and you don't even need a new device when you do. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/preet. That's mintmobile.com/preet. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/preet. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. Growth can be wonderful, but it comes with complications. Like finding that new pair of shoes for your kids when they get too big, or upgrading that puppy food to an adult recipe. And when you're a business owner, it's the same thing. You understand that as your company grows, the cracks can start to emerge and your tasks can get more complicated. That's why you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, 1.
37,000. That's the number of businesses which have been upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. One, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow, all in one place. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/preet. That's netsuite.com/preet to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/preet.
My guest this week is Chris Krebs. He was the director of CISA, an agency focused on cybersecurity at DHS. He was fired by Trump after establishing that the election was not, in fact, rigged by widespread election fraud. Now he's a founding partner at the Krebs Stamos Group, consulting on issues of cybersecurity, of which there are plenty.
Chris Krebs, thanks for joining us on the show.
Hey, Preet, thanks for having me on.
I understand you're in Vegas. We're going to violate the principle that what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas because this is all being put out wide distribution. So sorry about that. Is there any confession you want to make?
No. It's all normal here in Vegas, which is really surreal. But it's funny, you know, I saw you in LA last week. This is, I think, my fifth or sixth week on the road, and most of them have been West Coast trips. So like road warrior status is, you know, achievements unlocked. And here we are back kind of almost pre-COVID.
Is everyone wearing a mask at the blackjack table?
Oh, yeah. They're pretty. So at the Mandalay, at least, the security teams were pretty rigorous. If you're on the casino floor, at least for the less than 60 minutes I was on the floor last night, they're enforcing mask rules. Hey, I had a keynote I had to give this morning, and it was my first keynote in like a year and a half, 2 years. And I was like, do I remember how to do this? Right. No guardrails?
Would it help if you had a laptop in front of you and just looked into the cam?
Oh, no, I can't. I see, first off, like nobody wants to listen to a single individual spout off for 30 minutes.
Except on this podcast.
Right. But look, this is like a fireside chat where it's engaging, back and forth.
We'll see about
that. Like a person sitting there on a screen. So. Anyway.
So we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, October 5th. And I guess I need to ask you, given the events of yesterday, did you miss Facebook for the many hours it was down? Did you get along without it? Did you survive?
So I was actually on a plane, right? I had Wi-Fi connectivity, so I kind of saw this spiraling out over another social media platform, Twitter. But it was pretty surreal, right? Particularly if you think about the events of Sunday evening and 60 Minutes and the whistleblower.
The thing I saw at Facebook over and over again was there were conflicts of interest between what was good for the public and what was good for Facebook. And Facebook over and over again chose to optimize for its own interests, like making more money.
But to see this platform, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and then kind of the third-party dependencies they have across the e-commerce community and then their identity authentication measures. Like it was crazy to see the impact on the global the internet ecosystem.
As someone whose expertise is in, among other things, cybersecurity, do you immediately think when something like that happens that it was nefarious and there was some bad third-party actor?
So, yeah. I mean, so first off, I'm paranoid. I think you kind of have to be paranoid to be in these jobs and be successful. In fact, I had a nickname at DHS, at least in the early days with some of the leadership there. My nickname was Catastrophic Krebs.
That's long for a nickname.
But you see these things happen and it's too coincidental. It happens just after, you know, is there some sort of insider risk or something like that? But you really have to be disciplined here, particularly in leadership positions where you have a voice, and not throw kerosene on a smoldering or, you know, full burning fire, because that can lead to a lot of unnecessary panic. But for sure, there was the nagging thought in my mind that maybe somebody was disgruntled. Maybe somebody saw the 60 Minutes piece and wanted to kind of shut Facebook down off the internet. But like always, you know, there are a couple key pieces of internet infrastructure, and it's domain name system and Border Gateway Protocol, just the way that the routing across the internet works. Facebook jacked it up with an update, and then they couldn't fix it because they were all remotely deployed.
So your best assessment is it was not nefarious.
Oh no. And they, you know, whether you believe them or not, you know, they issued a statement. One of their people issued a statement this morning that said, no, it was not malicious. It was not nefarious. Again, they had their team distributed, you know, working remotely. They pushed an update to the system and that broke the remote connection. So they actually had to, from what I understand, this is rumor mill here, but they had to send a team to a data center. And then because the Facebook, the communications enterprise and the way that they use their badges to badge into conference rooms and data centers, that was broken too. So they had to actually bring an angle grinder to saw into the data center to get access to manually update the system. So it was just a catastrophic failure.
Catastrophic Krebs.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, there was a lot of joking about Facebook being down. And then you realize that among other properties, Facebook owns WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of places in the world, including the country of my birth and Israel, where I traveled, and Palestine, it's basically the essential mode of communication for people among their friends, family, coworkers. I mean, it sort of functions as a utility. Does the fact that all of that can go down so easily based on an error give you any thoughts or pause about the size of Facebook and the ways in which people should communicate and diversify?
So I think we got to separate a few things here, but to your point about WhatsApp, the thought immediately crossed my mind. That's how I communicate with a bunch of friends that are in the UK, for instance, and Singapore, and to your point, Israel. You know, it is one of the most stable, broadly used, effective in communications platforms, you know, whether you use other things.
Well, because it's free. People often ask, well, why do they use WhatsApp? Why not just text? In lots of places in the world, for the consumer at least, certain apps are free and texting may not be.
Right. The other issue with texting, right, is that it goes over the telephonic infrastructure, the telephony infrastructure, and therefore it does not have, and you know, as a former prosecutor, I'm sure you were dealing in the encryption debates.
Yes.
But you know, WhatsApp and Signal and others have that end-to-end encrypted capability that allows for more private conversations, particularly when you're talking about some of the countries out there that don't have the civil liberties and privacy protections that we have here. You know, it's a good way to get past some of the authoritarian surveillance regimes that are in place.
So what's the solution there?
The solution is keep a platform like WhatsApp up and running. but to your bigger point about is there a too big to fail here? I think we are, from a technology perspective, I think we're well past the moment of fully understanding and addressing systemic risk based on the various technologies and services that we use, whether it's whether it's a cloud infrastructure that, you know, 100% of the federal government runs on, you know, from Microsoft, or an authentication measure that runs in small and medium businesses like Facebook. I mean, I think a lot of people probably couldn't log into whatever their newspaper of choice is, because a lot of that login is enabled through things like Facebook. And so it's a really disruptive cascading effect. And we think about product features and ease of access rather than what happens when this thing breaks? What's my failover? What happened to the people that only or primarily contact, you know, communicate by WhatsApp? They couldn't do anything for 6 hours yesterday. So we have to think about that both from an organizational and infrastructure resilience perspective, but also a personal resilience perspective.
Yeah. And look, this time it was 6 hours. It makes you wonder, what if it's for 3 days? What if that's how businesses take appointments in their communities? And, you know, it's a huge rupture to the normal process. So I think you're right. So your area of expertise covers a lot of different discrete things. But since we don't have hours and hours, and I could talk to you for hours and hours, what I think is maybe the most salient thing to talk about, and I know this is close to you, given what you did before and what you continue to do now, and that's election security.
Mm-hmm.
So very famously after the 2020 election, when you were still in the government's employ, you said that the 2020 election was, quote, the most secure in American history, end quote. And I know you've talked about this a lot, but I want to ask you, for my listeners, why did you feel compelled to make that statement?
It's funny you frame the question that way, because I was just looking back over something that somebody had sent me a tweet earlier today. And I said something to the effect about a little under a year ago, that, you know, it was based on the work that we did at CISA, the Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security, that was the lead for election security, working with state and local partners that, you know, under the Constitution, as we've heard ad nauseum over the last year, are responsible for administering elections. We knew the work we had put in over 3.5 years. And here's just a quick metric, right? In 2016, less than 80% of votes cast in the presidential election had a paper ballot associated with it, which in paper gives you the ability to go back and audit, like a real audit, like what they've done in Georgia and Pennsylvania and Michigan, not the fake thing they just did in Arizona, but a real legitimate audit and recount, make sure you've got the right counts. So that was less than 80%. There were some systems that don't have any paper trail at all that make it really complicated to audit and therefore really convincingly from an evidence-based perspective demonstrate that there was no manipulation or hacking into that system. And those systems were in 2016 in Georgia, notably in Georgia and Pennsylvania. So in the intervening 3.5-4 years from 16 to 20, that number of paper records associated with a vote went up to about 95%. Now, part of it was due to the increase in mail-in ballots. And in fact, the entire state of New Jersey went to mail-in. But specifically, two states, Georgia and Pennsylvania, swapped out those old electronic-only machines to machines and equipment that used a paper ballot or scanned a paper ballot. And like, you know, that alone shows that we had confidence in the processes and we had the ability to go back and count it time and time again. Right. And then there's all the other Department of Defense, intelligence community, law enforcement stuff.
Right. No. So I get all that. And that's a good justification for the statement. But let me ask again, why did you feel the need to make the statement?
That's two different things, right?
Yeah.
You know, I had the confidence to make the statement in part because of that increase in paper ballots, but also the stuff that I knew the Department of Defense was doing and the intelligence community that were, the eye of Sauron. They were out there looking for interference from Russia and China, Iran and others. We had a good sense of what they were going to do and what their decision calculus was doing. But the reason we made the statement is because we anticipated initially adversaries, Russia, China, Iran and others, to try to discredit the processes and claim, absent any legitimate evidence, that there was a manipulation or some other sort of bastardization.
Wait, I'm sorry. Your initial thought was that foreign parties would cast aspersions on the security of the election?
Yep. Preet, this is the lead up, right? The planning factor, the planning.
And just if I'm clear, you made that statement not in response to an inquiry or a letter from Congress. That was a unilateral expression of confidence in the integrity of the 2020 election. Is that right?
Yes. Yep.
And so the next question is, because we know what happened after this, and I'd like you to recount some of the immediate history after you made that statement. Were you surprised in any way, given what you've just said, that actually the people casting aspersions on the security, not just the security, but the fairness and the integrity of the election came from Trump followers and supporters?
No, not at all. Let me kind of separate out two things here. Yeah. First is when, you know, at CISA, we were focused on the technical challenges associated with the administering a safe and secure election. Planning factors, as I mentioned, over 3.5 years, developed countless scenarios on what could be done by a bad actor to get in the middle of the process and disrupt it. And so we worked through all these things, but that was both on the technical cyber side as well as disinformation, you know, the perception hacking process. But ultimately, when you play out those scenarios, They're readily applicable to domestic actors as much as they are foreign actors. So again, we were focused on the technical challenges. But now where I am on the outside and I can, you know, sit back and look a little bit more at the structural and systemic issues at play here. All the telltale signs were there in 2016 with claims of a rigged election. This was imminently predictable. In fact, there were groups that saw this coming and helped prepare for it.
And what did you anticipate that Donald Trump himself would be angry about the statement?
Sure, right? His campaign, his lawyers, a bunch of his supporters, his advocates, his proxies were all talking about how there was massive fraud in this state or that state, or you know, their favorite kind of fallback is they were just asking questions. It was critically important that the people that know how elections work, and those are state and local officials who joined in on that statement, by the way, and they're actually the ones that drafted and issued it. I just repeated it and retweeted it. It's important that those that have that firsthand experience with the process were the ones saying, look, here's the ground truth. Here's what's happening out there. So as to whether I was surprised that the former president was upset by it,
Were you surprised? You know, I've shared some of this experience. Were you surprised that it seems to have been the reason for your firing?
No, I was shocked in the moment, but not overall surprised. I think, there's a certain philosophy where if you accept your mortality, you make a different set of decisions.
What took you so long to get fired? Some people managed to accomplish that in 7 weeks.
I know, it's like I'm almost talking to someone that pulled that off. We were just focused on the mission. We didn't get engaged in politics, and we had we generally approach things, not generally, but universally approach things in a bipartisan or even nonpartisan manner, whether it was cybersecurity in general or election security. And I told the team, so this is CISA, and as we were running up to the election, I think there were a lot of nervous people, like what's going to happen if we get, kind of under the thumb of the White House. And I said, there are kind of two things, or at least my management philosophy was, for this agency, for CISA to be successful, there are 5 P's that we need to focus on: people, policy, programs, public affairs, and politics. I said, that last P, politics, actually, that's not your problem. That's my problem. So you guys worry about the first 4 P's and I'll worry about the 5th P. And I think that gave some comfort to the team that as a Senate confirmed director of an agency, that I was looking out for him, that we were going to get the mission done.
There's some disconnect, it seems, when we talk about election security, integrity, whatever phrase you want to use. There's a disconnect between the way that the world seems to be moving in modern life, which is increasing technology, digital technology, using your devices. During the COVID pandemic, I've taken to using Apple Pay, contactless.
Mm-hmm.
I don't take the receipts because you're worried that, at least in the early days, should you be touching something that was touched by someone else? But in the voting and election universe, it seems like, for various reasons, which it would be wonderful for you to go through them and explain, we're going in the opposite direction. We're going more and more away from technology, perhaps in part because that's the way that people will get comfort. We're doing things in the same way we did them 100 years ago, paper ballots, et cetera, that's what gives them confidence, when in other areas of modern life, we're moving in favor of technology and away from paper. Does that make any sense?
No, it absolutely does. And I think there's a key difference here between voting, where you're insured a secret ballot where whom you voted for can't be traced back to you, and the flip side of digital technologies, your bank account, for instance, where you're seeking an immutability of the transaction. And this is where everybody's like, we need the blockchain. I was like, no, look, the whole point about online banking, for instance, is the bank knows exactly how much money you have and what transactions you're making. That, and they tie it back to you uniquely with an identifier. That is not how elections should work under the current tradition of a secret ballot. And that's why I am convinced that we are probably decades away from any sort of meaningful scale, deployed at scale digital voting technology like mobile phones. And the other thing is, like, look, it's also, it limits access, because yes, you and I might have access to the latest, iPhone with super, you know, security features, but there are a lot of people out there that aren't even on secure phones that use, you know, flip phones. There are actually members of Congress that still use flip phones, but the, you know, they're marginalized communities that just don't have access to the same technology. So whatever we do here, we need to make sure that there's a level playing field, and it make it easy to vote.
Is the biggest issue at this moment then not necessarily how the voting takes place on election day or in the days leading up to election day if there's early voting, but the ability to audit later in a way that will convince people who are increasingly suspicious of elections that the election was kosher?
I didn't mean to
provoke that sound.
It just drives me crazy because, you know, everything you're hearing in the kind of the aftermath of the Arizona, you know, air quote audit here, where you're seeing it, you know, between Georgia trying to, you know, audit the ballots in Fulton County, the four counties in Texas, this request for audits in Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, it could go on. There are best practices. There are standards. There are professionals that conduct and administer post-election audits already. And they do it in a transparent way with bipartisan representation. They aren't, you know, from obviously biased contractors that make up their processes on the fly and don't provide meaningful access and transparency to the Fourth Estate. It's there are processes. Stop calling these stupid things audits. They're not. They're you know, partisan inquests at best.
Yeah, but the question remains. In other words, you have an undeniable trend now. I'll not put words in your mouth, but I'll speak for myself, of people like Donald Trump urging on his supporters not to believe any election result that was adverse to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you have increased, I'm not saying it's legitimate, I'm not saying it's done in good faith, but you have increased suspicion and disbelief in election results that are unfavorable to Donald Trump. That is going to be true in 2022.
Yep.
In the midterms and 2024. And given that rise in suspicion, whether it's good faith or well-founded or not, does that, to your mind, necessitate some different way of dealing with elections and election security in the future, which is not an issue of technology and integrity per se, but it's about dealing with the citizenship problem we have,
yeah,
where people just don't want to believe you. You know, you go and you cast your ballot and say, well, I don't believe you. Like, where's the proof? Does it necessitate a change?
I think we've kind of lost our way from a civics education perspective. And by the way, I'm not naive enough to think that this is going to fix everything. I'm just kind of giving some of the context setting for, I think, why we're where we are. So just civics in general have fallen off the books. People just don't engage with their local officials. And so we've somehow arrived at a point where everyone believes, in part, you know, influenced by the president, the former president rather, saying, you know, the voting should be done that night and all the counting should be done the night of the election, which is not, nor has it ever been that way, right? Mail-in ballots, you know, overseas ballots from service members, they come in after the election day. So I think for one, we've got to get back to the basics of communications and education. And I think this past election has really opened the eyes of a lot of election officials on how they need to be much more proactive, much more aggressive on the mechanics of voting and what the timelines look like. So I think that's step one. Step two is continue to push towards eradication of those machines that don't have a paper trail. And then full 50 state plus territory post-election pre-certification audits that will again establish the facts of the election and that the initial count was consistent with the ultimately certified count. I think those are just two quick steps. But the third, look, the biggest problem here, to your point, is the former guy. You know, former President Trump continues to baselessly promote these conspiracy theories that there was a. And look, he's not the craziest about it, right? I mean, Sidney Powell's stuff is out of control. But this is a steady state. He goes to
Lynn Wood is now making waves by saying outright and in public that 9/11 was staged.
He's a truther, right? I mean, it just, but look, ultimately, I think that is going to you know, that's going to agitate and activate the fever swamp. We have to kind of assume that a non-zero percentage, probably closer to 20%, if not more, slightly more, of the American population are just irretrievably gone. They will not accept facts.
It might be a lot more. I mean, this is the problem, Chris.
Yeah.
It used to be the fever swamp folks were a small percentage, and for good or ill, depending on your perspective, maybe they didn't have a lot of political leverage. But I've seen some polls, I don't have it in front of me, that suggest that 70% of Republicans, and I don't know what percentage of the whole population that is, but 70% of the Republicans believe that Donald Trump won the election. So now you're starting to get into crazy numbers. And I don't know that that's going to abate anytime soon. And I guess one of the things that you and I are talking about is how through procedure and process and technology and election voting systems do we begin to, you know, eat away at that and erode that lack of confidence. Maybe it's not possible. Are you optimistic?
You know, I think we can round the edges off. I think we have to continue pushing through, like I said, on the technology side and on the practices and the communications and the transparency side. But what's really so upsetting to me is that there are kind of like four levels of government involvement with election administration, election confidence. You know, it starts down at the state and local level in the legislatures. And I think that's where you're really starting to see things unravel, like some of the state senators in Arizona, some of the state officials or, you know, elected officials in Texas and elsewhere, that, you know, it's politically advantageous for them to promote this garbage because it activates their base. They get fundraising, they get voters. And that kind of like that illiberal political cynicism, we've got to figure out a way where that doesn't work in their favor anymore. You know, my hope is that just the general voter, we'll call it, like, you know, recognize it for what it is. The second level is those folks that are elected into the executive branch at the state level. So secretaries of state, for instance, you have election deniers, you know, stop the stealers running for secretary of state in Georgia, in Arizona, and elsewhere. And you're putting them in a position, if they're elected, to actually be, you know, have the pin on certifying results. What's going to happen in 24, right? And then you start leveling up to the federal level, and you've got the Congress, where, you know, you continue to hear from particularly in the House, though I am concerned there's some more radical types that may be successful in a Senate seat. But you have members of the House that push this stuff. And so it's really a layer. There is no single option, single solution here. And what particularly makes it complicated at the federal level, particularly with the elected officials and serving in the House, is the speech and debate clause. They hide behind that, and it makes it really hard, other than every 2, 4, or 6 years, to hold them accountable for the things they say.
We'll be right back with more of my conversation with Chris Krebs after this.
This week on The Pitch, it's tween time.
We're redefining feminine hygiene for tweens.
You've done 5 million in sales. You did 3 million last year. Very impressive.
Thank you.
I really believe in this category. I'm an investor in a company called Aunt Float.
And similarly, I'm a personal investor in Ruby Love.
Like Elizabeth and Charles, I have seen a lot of these companies. Mm-hmm. I've never made an investment in the space. You should be raising more than $500,000.
As a Black woman, for me to come on here and say, I'm going to become the new Always, that's super yes. audacious. And I could
Love
we,
Always.
For sure.
What makes it audacious?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
That's what I wanted to hear.
I get the sense back her experience might have been a little different.
Save the mic.
That looked really expensive.
This week on The Pitch, Monica Williams drops the mic. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Hearing you talk, it occurs to me, and this is true in other contexts as well, do we have too many election systems? I'm not sure it can be changed. You know, the Constitution leaves time, place, and manner of the setting of elections to the states. So that's the federalism system that we have. But would it be easier if all the states and localities had a common set of principles about voting and mechanisms for voting? How much does that play a role in confusion and in suspicion?
So there are a set of, you know, general timelines they have to meet under federal law and statute, you know, seating the Electoral Congress all the way back, you know, through certification and safe harbor deadline of, you know, December 14th or whatever it was this past year. But from a tactical, operational, boots on the ground, administering elections, it really does change. It does depend. You know, state by state. If you've seen one state's requirements for elections, you've seen one state, and it's based on geography, on, you know, rural communities, about urban density. You know, trying to administer election in a highly rural or even, you know, just like Oregon, for instance, is going to be so much different than Rhode Island or Massachusetts. So I'm not convinced that there needs to be a single approach to election administration in the U.S. because I just don't think it would work. But we certainly need much clearer guidelines on technology. We need more stringent cybersecurity requirements out of the Election Assistance Commission and some of the certifications that they issue for equipment. But you know, this really just comes down to, it's like we've got to be able to penalize and hold accountable those that spread nonsense and lies about the outcome of an election.
And hopefully we can do it in some way other than companies who work in elections and make machines suing for defamation, right? That
it takes
seems not
long.
To be the best way to regulate.
So, I mean, this is actually one of those things I think we as a kind of an election security and administration community need to take a hard look at some of the lessons learned from the 2020 election. And, you know, I've talked to the Dominion folks about this, but what other legal remedies were available to them in October or November where they could have sought some sort of, you know, injunctive relief against some of the people that were talking about, you know, dead Venezuelan dictators that had compromised their systems.
But it's fraught to do that. I mean, they're not DOJ, and DOJ has, you know, prudential rules and policies on this and guidelines, but it's still pretty fraught for a company like Dominion to be bringing preemptively some big hype lawsuit in the days leading up to an election, don't you think?
No, you're absolutely right. But I think we have to kind of test these waters. But look, so they have filed suit against, you know, various individuals associated with the campaign, media outlets. You know, some of the individuals are judgment proof. Like, they're not going to get any money out of some of these people. But even if they do get to a resolution and they have, you know, at least verbally indicated that they're not going to settle, that they're going to take this to the, you know, the very end, that's 2+ years out, maybe. And by then the damage has been done. And, you know, they've already talked about, you know, in some of their legal filings about how they've lost contracts at the state or county level because the election officials are scared, because they're like, our people, you know, aren't going to vote if they see Dominion because they bought that bill of goods that the former president and his acolytes were selling.
Let me try to ask a question whose answer maybe is implied in what you've been saying, but let me ask it in this way. Is there a system that can be devised for voting in any particular jurisdiction that is human proof? In other words, is every system of voting ultimately going to be reliant upon the good faith and integrity of the humans, whether that's election officials or the Secretary of State with the state legislature? Is it ultimately going to depend on the good faith and integrity of those people, or can you do something to insulate from those people?
So from a practical perspective, you want to eliminate single points of failure as much as possible. And there's a concept in election administration as it relates to technology of software independence. And basically that means you never want technology or software or hardware, to be a single point of failure in your election process, that you have redundancies, you have checks and controls throughout the process, front to back, that will either identify, detect, mitigate, or, just flat out stop any sort of, compromise of the system. That goes from a policy perspective as well. We have checks and balances throughout the process at the state level and at the federal level. I think that keep us from having to be highly reliant upon a single individual, like, the Vice President of the United States counting the ballot, counting the slates or whatever. So I think those processes are in place. I just don't know if the biggest problem here is that the big lie about how the election was stolen, all the things that could have been done in the Eastman memo and elsewhere, they never had to worry about being accurate or truthful or actually having the law on their side. It's Garry Kasparov has talked about this, but it's the flood of lies. It's asymmetry. They're not trying to win you over. They're trying to get you to lose the perception of what's real and what's true. And if they do that, you're a lost cause.
So I think your answer then is, which is disturbing but not unexpected, is that we can focus a lot on policies, on rules, on statutes, but if the folks who are responsible at the end of the day for saying yay or nay are not good people, we're going to have a problem.
That's how it's always been, right?
Yeah. I mean, I say that, it seems obvious, but I feel like that's a missed point.
Yeah, I mean, look,
for some folks.
I mean, the reason we've gotten as a country 250 some odd years down the road is because we had good faith actors for the most part for the majority of that time. Yes, there have been, some free radicals and those that were of a more illiberal approach or viewpoint. But it's really disconcerting, kind of this orthogonal departure from liberal democracies that we're seeing out of a pretty significant chunk of the Republican Party right now. And that's,
there used to be less Kraken.
Yeah.
Right. There was less Kraken. I think that's the solution, less Kraken. So more so, I know what your answer is going to be, but I want you to flesh it out a little bit more, because a particular technological leap has been suggested by a number of people, but included among them is Andrew Yang, formerly ran for president, formerly ran for mayor of New York City, who said, wouldn't it be great if we could vote from our phones? He tweeted that. Your response was
Danny DeVito,
the equivalent of an eye roll. Representative Eric Swalwell also got into the mix, saying, wouldn't it be great if we could figure out a way for people to vote on their phones? Could you be specific as to why that's a bad idea in your view?
Look, I get the interest and the willingness and the kind of excitement about, like, can't we just do this technology thing? We're the most technologically advanced society on the face of the earth. But again, we are the technologies that we use today for banking and other online transactions are not set up for, again, the concept of a secret ballot. There's metadata. There's so many other indicators and little pieces of digital exhaust associated with how we operate that ultimately would make it really hard to do a secret balloting process.
Can I ask a sure. question about that? Cause I don't understand the technology as well as you and other people. I mean, anonymity is needed for many things that we do, including electronic medical records. And maybe this is a terrible analogy, but we do accept some risk that those things can be hacked. And it would be embarrassing for large populations of people. But as we get further in the modern world and for ease and for treatment purposes, particularly in a pandemic, we've seen a rise in electronic communication of medical information, protected sensitive health information. How is voting different from that? Maybe that's a silly way of putting it.
Well, I mean, any way you cut it, some healthcare provider still has your records, your name, and your medical history on it. So let's put this into a practical context, right? So let's say we use some sort of digital voting that associates your identity, even if it's a unique identifier that could potentially down the road be tied back to you, but they have your voting history. And let's say you trust, going back to your point about human proofing, you may trust the Secretary of State today, but what if some nut job gets elected in there, and then they have the ability to look up your voting history and look actually not just if you voted, but whom you voted for down the slate. And
and there's a market for that. And there's a market for that information.
Well, not just from a campaigning perspective, but also don't discount the fact that political retribution is a possible thing. I mean, it has happened before, not just here, but obviously elsewhere. So, but as long as we're committed to a secret ballot system, there are ways to do this where using physical media, physical format media, paper, that can separate the identity from the vote. And yes, there are likely ways to do this with technology. But the installation base, so that means that the 330 million or however many eligible voters that are out there in the United States will not have the same access to the technology needed to do this in a secure way. Maybe 10% would, and that is not for nothing.
And am I correct that no voting system that aspires to be safe and have integrity should be hardwired to the internet?
That's absolutely the best practice. I think the Election Assistance Commission has some guidance on that. CISA has some guidance on that. My old agency has some guidance. But yeah, I mean, you don't need to be connected to the internet. There's no requirement for most applications, certainly for the voting machine that you cast your vote on. There's virtually no scenario where that would be useful. There are some arguments on the tabulator side where you want to be able to modem out the unofficial results. And that's why, again, it's important to have paper, because even if there was a connection and even if there was an attempted intrusion or a successful compromise, you still have the paper records that you can go back and audit over and over. Georgia, they counted three times, right. Three times. And guess what?
Hoping it's going to be different.
They were consistent. So I think that's, yeah. That's the part that, that's again, so critical. The ability to conduct evidence-based elections to maintain confidence, it has to be the first imperative.
So last question on this, and then I want to talk about some other stuff. If you could start from scratch or build an election system in a state, catastrophic Krebs, all you, what are the main principles and mechanisms that would make it, in your mind, not just the safest and most secure, but be perceived to be the safest and most secure?
Well, there's a difference here, right, between, in practical terms, what is safe and secure, and then what the narrative has developed around of safe and secure.
I mean, both are important. That's why I keep asking both.
Right. Yeah. I think just from a practical perspective, it's maximum paper. With very, very clear and effective ballot design. And that's something that we tend to not talk a lot about. But there, not all ballots across the country are designed and configured the same way. And that's even at the state level, at the county level. And you can have precinct level differences in, school board. You're voting on the same ballot, and at least in the Commonwealth of Virginia, same ballot may be on the backside that you're voting for the president, and that's going to change. And so it's really about good practices on designing the ballot, having very clear processes for how they're getting counted, good chain of custody, post-election audits, risk-limiting audits, scientifically based audits to confirm the outcome before certification. So it's not after, but it's before certification, so you can confirm. And transparency in the canvassing process, just to make sure that you've done the things properly to ensure that every person that was registered and eligible to vote was able to do so, and that there are no sort of, you know, departures from the norm. Now, that's different though, because now you hear all these things about how mail-in voting is, susceptible to massive voter fraud, despite all the available evidence. And the additional controls that are in place where, hey, you can request a ballot, but you may not use it. You can go in and vote in person. And then they're just, you know, signature verification and all those other things that we've lost the narrative through that flood of lies about, you know, what the things that matter in the process. And we've kind of been snowed over by some of the grifters.
It's not even the lies. It's the willing belief in those lies. Mm-hmm. In the face of contrary evidence, you know, so it almost doesn't matter. I mean, this distinction I keep drawing between what is safe and secure and what is perceived to be safe and secure. And I think for some subset of folks, at least at this moment, there's no bridging that. You know, nothing you can say to them, and this is because the lie has been perpetrated, but also, you know, willingly believed. There's nothing you can say to them that will convince them that Trump lost Georgia. You can count it 94 times. You can have Sidney Powell can be disbarred. Doesn't matter.
So I would actually go and look at Arizona and their recently completed, again, air quotes here, audit.
Frauded, some people call
right,
it.
Right. That found that, in fact, Trump had fewer votes than initially thought and Biden had more. And then the pivots are remarkable, right? The pivot by the Stop the Steal crowd are like, oh, the Cyber Ninjas team was pressured to release that report, or some other party came in. So now the true believers of Stop the Steal have turned on State Senate President Karen Fann, and they're like, oh, they're not strong enough. They were intimidated. The deep state's right. Gotten to them. So right.
There's always someone you can scapegoat for not giving you the result that you want.
Yeah. Well, that yes, and then. But I do think through part of this, we continue, as I said, we're rounding off edges. We're chipping away at the people that are either on the fence or kind of teeter-tottering over into the fever swamp. And we are seeing, even in the QAnon movement, we're seeing people like, enough. This is too much. You haven't delivered any results. And it's I'm done. I've lost family over this. It's time to move on.
Right. So we face a lot of issues, a lot of threats on the cyber front. And I wonder if you have a thought about the fall. I raise this issue from time to time, and I worked in the Congress. And I watch members of Congress in the House and the Senate when they conduct hearings, and sometimes you see this in the legislation they write, that they're not necessarily so sophisticated about technology and about the cyber threats. And people get terms wrong, and sometimes tech executives come before Congress, and it's a cakewalk for them. Because many members are just not fluent. They're just not savvy. Do you worry that members of Congress don't have the sophistication needed to deal with the threat?
I have no idea what you're talking about. This is, I've been very impressed by, no, look, I mean, there are people that take advantage of that, the ability to throw a, 100 mile an hour high tech fastball, and there's no possible follow up, and you see it all the time. I think it's important that we ensure that the technical sophistication expertise is resident in the committee staffs and in the personal staffs. I think the Tech Fellow program that is just reemerging in Congress right now. I have a current employee that is applying into that program. It just gives that, it raises the bar in terms of understanding, helps craft better policy, kind of can call the lobbyists out for, the BS when they try to lay it down. I think that is probably one of the most critical, investments that Congress can make, but on the elected official, I can't see absent, maybe the Bay Area, and maybe, parts of the Pacific Northwest or the Seattle area, where a, technology savvy member of Congress has any sort of kind of electoral differentiator, they would get him into Congress more. So I think we got to work it at the staff level.
Yeah. Although staff don't get to ask the questions at the hearings. This is an example I use over and over again. and maybe it's changed since he said it, but Lindsey Graham said not that long ago, and he's not a, whatever you think of him, he's a smart guy. He said just recently in the last few years that he had never sent an email. It's hard to understand when we're talking about level of sophistication, how a body of lawmakers, some of whom have literally never sent an email, can understand some of these very, very, very much more complicated things, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think there are reasons for things like that, not sending emails. I mean, part of it's operational security, right? You don't want to put anything of your words.
Look, I mean, he said it, I think he said it in fairness to him, in the context of saying he was ahead of his time because he can't get hacked. His yeah. emails are not going to be on Drudge
yep.
because he doesn't send them.
But also they have staff do everything for them, right? But to your larger point, yes, there is an absolute knowledge gap in how technology works. But I mean, that's not even the worst part of it, right? It's yes, on the Congress and the regulatory side, but it's just the average person has no idea how these things work that they're rolling out into their homes and how to maintain them and what sort of data is being collected on a daily basis and what sorts of things they're willingly turning over just to get the latest app or little widget. The best example here is right is Facebook. There are 1,000 examples here with Facebook, but the one I like is all the quizzes, right? Like, tell me, you know, your first car when you were a kid and your favorite dog and all that. It's like, people, this is a social engineering experiment. They're collecting information on you and building a profile, you know, and bad people can do bad stuff with all that information.
Hey, today, just tell me the first 4 digits of your social.
Yeah, raise your hand if you're a January birthday. It's like stuff like that.
Two days later, give us the last few digits of your social. Oh, I see. Chris Cribbs, thanks for spending time with us. It's been great.
Hey, Preet, thanks so much.
My conversation with Chris Cribbs continues for members of the Cafe Insider community. To try out the membership free for 2 weeks, head to cafe.com/insider. Again, that's cafe.com/insider. So I want to end the show this week with a bit of news that's important to me personally, which will become obvious in a moment, but also more importantly, is consequential for New York and indeed for the country. And it's about my old office, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. You may not realize this, but the last time someone was Senate confirmed to that position was me over 12 years ago. And after I was fired, there were, of course, competent, excellent people who've been in charge of that office. But I think it makes a difference if someone is actually presidentially appointed and Senate confirmed and is a permanent person to be in that position. So as of Tuesday night of this week, we have a Senate confirmed U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for the first time in a number of years. That U.S. attorney is Damien Williams, who I know very well. In fact, a number of years ago when I ran the office, I interviewed him, the team interviewed him, and I hired him. As I told the New York Times when they were writing a profile about Damien, he was an absolute no-brainer hire. He's incredibly smart. He's incredibly talented. He clerked on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals for then-Judge Merrick Garland, who, wonder what happened to that guy, but it should mean for a good relationship between SDNY and Maine Justice, because the Attorney General and Damien have known each other for a long time. Then Damien went on to clerk for Justice John Paul Stevens, came to the SDNY office as a young person, immediately shined, is an excellent, excellent trial lawyer, and eventually was promoted to head the Securities Fraud Unit, which of course is a difficult job and handles very sophisticated cases. And he'll be sworn in soon as the next U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. And I just wanted to express my pride in Damien, my happiness that the office will have a permanent leader. I think the office will be in incredibly good hands because Damien has good judgment. He's open-minded. He'll be tough, but fair, understands the traditions of doing justice. I should also mention, not to be remiss, that there is also a new Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney in the, you know, I guess, rival office, the Eastern District of New York. Breon Peace, who served in that office some years ago, has long been a partner at the esteemed law firm of Cleary Gottlieb in New York City, was also confirmed on Tuesday evening. He's also a great and talented lawyer and will lead that office well. Now, both men have a lot on their plates, some we know about because of public reporting and because of court proceedings. In the Southern District of New York, Ghislaine Maxwell, however you pronounce her name, is set to go on trial Damien will be overseeing that. There's the ongoing saga of the investigation of the former U.S. attorney himself, Rudy Giuliani. That's a sensitive investigation, and no doubt a complicated and difficult one. Damien will be overseeing that as well. And then there's probably all sorts of cases that you and I know nothing about, investigations that are at the early stages. And then there will be matters that come up over time. New York is still the target of terrorist attacks. Wall Street is still there with lots and lots of frauds and deceptions waiting to happen. So Damien has a lot on his plate. Same with Breon Peace in the Eastern District, among other things. Notably, for example, the investigation and prosecuting of Tom Barrack, one of the former associates of President Trump. Both Damien and Breon are excellent picks, recommended by my former boss, Senator Chuck Schumer, for their excellence and for their talent and for their judgment. And I just wanted to say to the people of both of those offices, you're very lucky to have them. I wish them luck and the fortitude to do the right thing in the right way for the right reasons in every decision they make. And also, on occasion, the strength to withstand criticism with grace. Good luck. Congratulations, Damien Williams and Breon Peace. Well, that's it for this episode of Stay Tuned. Thanks again to my guest, Chris Krebs. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to staytuned@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your host is Preet Bharara. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staden, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Jennifer Korn, Chris Boylan, and Sean Walsh. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.